Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3.
Okay, it's the 16th of October, 2010. I'm Dan O'Neill. I am with Charlie Campbell and Ruth Althoff in their cabin in Tanana, Alaska. And we're going to talk about king salmon every which way. And Charlie is my brother-in-law, and Ruth is my sister-in-law. Okay, Charlie, what do you want to say about the history what you know about the king salmon in this area of the Yukon and people's utilization of it and the historic strength of the runs and stuff like that?
Okay, well, my knowledge of the history, you know, personally, as far as a fisherman, dates back about maybe 20 years or something like that.
No, not longer than that.
No, that's kind of when I got going with Barbara. That's the first I was fishing kings. Before that, I had fished chums, but that's about as far back as I go.
1990?
Mm-hmm. 89, yeah, when Colin was born.
Hmm.
So now, you don't want to go on a tape disagreeing with your husband, do you?
I don't have a problem with it.
All right.
Is there a mute that we can employ with
each
other?
Okay, I'll shut up.
So, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, my picture of it was that, you know, way back, it was guys standing on the rocks up in the rapids, which is 35 miles above Tanana. 40 miles above Tanana, and they had big dip nets, and they'd stand up on the point and just kind of make sweeps with the dip nets and get king salmon. Not sure if they had some kind of nets in addition to that, but pretty soon after contact they had gill nets, and that kind of got to be the preferred way of fishing. Fish wheels were introduced. They used fish traps as well. I don't know if they used those for kings. I would expect not so much, because the kings are out in the current. They powerful. They tend to be further offshore. One reason why rapids is such a good fishing spot is because the current's very swift. It's a place where it's quite deep, and the shore drops off steeply. So
say where rapids is.
Rapids is about 40 miles upstream of Tanana on the Yukon River. It's called the Rapids. It's been a fishing spot for a long, long time, and people...
The fish have to go into shore.
The fish have to go close to shore so they're accessible. That's why it's a good spot. And, you know, people who are in their 70s and 80s around, who in Tanana, remember when there was tons of camps up there. Every little creek had a camp, and people would go up there in the summer and sometimes stay the whole summer, fish for king salmon, which came first. That was entirely people food, as far as what I understand. Yellow scraps and heads and stuff like that would go to the dogs. But a lot of that actually was sought after as well for people food. If, you know, people would cook the heads into soup, and so it was. This was the premium fish. Later on in the summer, the chum salmon run would arrive in August, and people would fish for their dogs and put up chum salmon, dry them, and stay until September. And there wasn't much in the way of trips to town in those days. Maybe once down to Tanana around the 4th of July to go to the dance down there, and that would be about it. Very few people, even after motors became available, there was very few people who had them. Most people used the dogs to pull their boats up, and they employed long, skinny, kind of flat-bottom boats, which they built in order to get up there. Then, as the... okay, I'll get to that here in a little bit. Then as it got to be into the late 60s, early 70s, they created limited entry, and this was a statewide phenomenon. It was an attempt to sort of regulate the fishery by restricting the number of fishermen, and once, if you had been a fisherman and could sort of prove it, document it, you got a limited entry permit and you were entitled to sell fish commercially. And that was a big break from the past. Before that, fish strips, which is, you know, dried king salmon made for human consumption, salted and sun-dried and smoked, was kind of the was a tradable commodity, as was dog food, chum salmon. You could sell dog food at the Tanana or Alaska Commercial Store in Fairbanks in Tanana. They were fairly strict about what they took. It had to have 12 vents, and it had to be smoked, and of course anything resembling fly blow, and you wouldn't be able to sell it. They bought it, they would make it into bales, and they would then sell it to trappers and other people who needed these fish. It was the gasoline of the era, since this was before the era of snow machines. When limited entry opened up, and people would also sell whole kings, sort of as the need was available, and it depended on the location. For example, in Rampart in the 60s, there was a guy named Ira Wiesner who bought king salmon. He was the local storekeeper, postmaster, sort of everything guy, and he, among the other things he did, he'd freeze king salmon and then sell them. And it was a fairly unregulated trade at that time. So then along came limited entry and this attempt to sort of rationalize the fishery. And I think it got off to sort of a slow start in the interior, but once it got going, fishermen were making a fairly good living at it. And I don't know the numbers of king salmon that came up, but they were way above what come up now. And there was not really much of any sense of shortage at that time. Then so people could do this commercial fishery, and they could also do sort of the traditional fish strips and smoked salmon. But Department of Fish and Game never allowed the sale of these subsistence caught fish. That was sort of supposed to be in a separate category. And in a lot of ways, this trade, which had gone on, you know, kind of forever, of sale of smoked salmon, continued, but it was sort of just not talked about. It was something that was sort of not supposed to happen, because, you know, with the sale of commercial fish, you know, you're supposed to adhere to very strict reporting requirements, very strict health department regulations, not enforced by Fish and Game, but nonetheless they, you know, sanctioned all that. So anyway, that went on kind of into the 80s. Then sort of as time went on, I think it was kind of towards the late 80s, you know, there began to be some sort of throttling down of this activity. For example, subsistence, somewhere along the line, probably in the late 70s, subsistence went from being a 7-day-a-week affair down to a 5-day-a-week affair.
It was when commercial, once you had a commercial on Kings, then you went from 7 days down to 5 days.
Okay, that's when it started. Okay.
Until that point, and so if they didn't give you a commercial till the middle of July, then you could fish 7 days a week. And as soon as there was a commercial opening, then you automatically went to 5 days a week for the rest of the king season.
Okay, but there was some point when they first started that, because I think before that it was...
Yeah.
I know, I remember Lester talking about...
Yeah, before
when
that
they
it
first
wasn't.
When they first instituted 5 day a week, everybody was a little kind of outraged, but then everybody found that they could just do fine with that, and they actually kind of welcomed
fish.
The rest. And so what it sort of told me was that the fish were pretty abundant.
Yeah, the only thing with when you go to 5 days or when they limit you, if the weather doesn't line up good for you to cut on the days that you're open, and it's nice when you're closed, then you're still it kind of kind of constrains you that way to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a cold water creek, you can keep the fish for a full day before. So you could save them up for, hopefully the weather would be good the next day. But that was the only problem with going to, when you couldn't do 7 days a week, you could just fish whenever you needed to.
Yeah.
You weren't constrained by this time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Coming through loud and clear?
Yep. I was wondering if Ruth's was too low, but I'm getting it okay.
Okay.
Okay, so... then we get into...
Okay, just don't fidget with it.
Yeah, just sit very, very still.
Well, sometimes that happens.
I'll put it up here.
Speak slowly and clearly into the microphone. So anyway, then we get into the 90s, and things are kind of beginning to get more complicated. Up to this point, both kings and chums have been fairly abundant. An interesting...
You could say something about when they started drift netting down there?
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Okay.
One peculiarity of this limited entry, the institution of limited entry, is that they kind of froze the status quo at the time as far as what you could catch commercially. Subsistence, you could catch whatever you wanted to, but you were supposed to report it. And there's a method for that, which I could tell you later if you could remind me.
What do you mean, though? I mean, report number and species?
Yes.
Number and species.
Okay.
Right, number of fish and species. You're supposed to keep track of that. Post-season, you'd submit the results. There's no in-season submission required, even to this point, at least in our district. But anyway, down at the mouth, it's a fairly densely populated area, so... lots of people fishing, that's kind of like their main thing down there, was at the time. A lot less in the way of wage work and other possible sources of employment. So the sense I get of it was every person a fishery, every person a fisherman, and there's something like, I want to say, either 600 or 800 permits extant down there. And that would compare to, in our district,
40?
Yeah, there might be like 40 wheel permits or something like that, and the same number of net permits. I'm guessing at that. That doesn't mean that everybody always fishes that.
Almost nobody.
They fishes their permits, or did then, but there was certainly a preponderance of them down in the lower river. And they also grandfathered in whatever the fishing method was at the time. There had been a really major sort of abuse of the species that happened, I think, down around the late teens or 20s, and that was the fish traps that they had down in the lower Yukon, and they were really killing the kings with those, as my understanding anyway. And but then the feds got involved in that. They banned the use of the fish traps, which were mainly being run, I think, by white outside influences. They're not influences, but entrepreneurs. And that was seen as a big abuse at the time, and they got rid of that, and everybody felt that had been a good change, and that it was a lot better for the fish as well, because they were probably overfishing them. Then what they had kind of evolved to was fishing drift nets and set nets down on the lower river. Set nets are attached to shore. That's a stationary thing. You have to find an eddy to put them in. There are a limited number of eddies, so that is sort of a limit on how many set net spots and therefore fishermen there might be. However, some of those spots are very productive. But what they also did and what they allowed to continue with when they made limited entry is drift netting, which is a highly effective way of fishing and also open to a lot more people on account of its a mobile thing. What they'll typically do is drive up to the head of an inside bend with a nice smooth sandbar where the fish are basically going to have to go around the sandbar, around this inside bend, but they're going to be at a certain depth. They're not going to be right up at the beach. They're going to be, you know, like in maybe 14 feet of water or something like that. And the lower river is particularly good for this because, you know, there's very little in the way of rocks down there. It's all almost entirely alluvial, so there's this nice smooth bottom. They put a buoy with one end of the net out. They kind of drive backwards, lay the net out perpendicular to shore, and then drift down with the current and try to keep a little tension on the net so it's kind of halfway straight. They like to have a little sort of a curtain effect because they think that catches more fish. And they'll drift for maybe 3/4 of an hour until they start to see the corks bobbing up and down, and then they haul the net in, pick the fish out, and repeat. Sometimes they'll be sort of taking turns, but it's a big river and there's quite a few fishing spots, so the long and the short of it was that lots of people were able to do it. In the mid-80s, it had kind of gotten to the point where it was a pretty lucrative fishery, to the point where it wasn't just the local guys going out, but there were some people who bought permits sort of on spec and went down there to fish. Gas was cheaper there, but it's a long way down the river to get there. You have to drive all the way down some 700 miles, basically, to get to the fishing grounds. But it was worth some people's while to do so. But the value of the permit, which is not set, that's a market-driven thing. You know, it rises and falls. Got up to around $30,000, which and it was a pretty lucrative thing at that time. But then, as I say, as it got into I'm going to back up once more. This is 80s stuff. Another thing that was kind of going on all along here is that there was a sort of a sense of quid pro quo, even though the upper river didn't have much of a quota for king salmon.
For commercial.
They don't call it a quota. They call it a guideline harvest limit or range or something like that. But it, at least in latter years, that was somewhere up around, I think, 8,000 fish, maybe 5,000 fish, as opposed to the lower river. They were taking, I want to say, like 40,000 fish or something. You should check on those figures with Fish and Game, has that historical information. But it was quite disproportionate. But the upper river was basically okay with it. They were making some okay money off of king salmon.
Commercially.
The way they would do that was through set nets and fish wheels. There's no drift netting allowed in the upper river. That was grandfathered in, but fish wheels and set nets were. Both of those are more dependent on having a certain specific fishing spot, so that kind of became self-limiting. And the people who did it did sort of a combination of things to make a living. They would fish for king salmon and sell them commercially. When the commercial season wasn't open, they would fish subsistence, and they'd put up fish strips either for themselves or their family or to sell or trade or what have you, what they now call customary trade, which is very controversial. Then when chum season came, there was an okay chum commercial season.
The first chums that come up are good people food.
Yeah, and then they would be able to cut fish for their dogs. For one reason or another, it appears that people in the lower river got rid of their dogs before the people in the upper river did. And I'm not sure quite why that is, but it might very well have something to do with the fact that the interior was kind of like the center of dog mushing, the center of dog mushing racing, and it was just had a longer and more solid tradition, Perhaps the distances are longer. Certainly the timing of the run with chum salmon arriving, it fits in perfectly with the interior because the weather's turning cool. It's a good time to hang and dry fish.
That aren't in a smokehouse.
Rather than in a smokehouse. It's drier than the lower river. So a lot of things lined up for the upriver to be able to exploit the chum salmon. So that was kind of like the subsistence cycle, as it were, during the summer in say the area around Tanana. A little of this, a little of that, it all kind of came together. Something that happened in the 80s is that there was a very good market for chum salmon eggs to be sold to Japan. And every fish plant around the state at that time that had access to chums, and I think other species as well, maybe even pinks as well, but the chums were sought after by the Japanese, produced this specialty product. And sometimes it was, the Japanese, it was lucrative enough and a specialty product that the Japanese felt compelled to send people over to work in these fish plants who did nothing but handle the eggs. And it would be two or three of these technicians. They would get the eggs and they would do their thing with them, pack them into these wooden boxes, salt them, and then they would get sent to Japan.
Where were these guys?
These guys would be located in a fish plant, say in Kodiak or
Manly, Fairbanks.
The Japanese technicians.
Here. And it'd be, yeah, there was a fish plant here briefly.
Yeah, and these guys would, I don't know if the Japanese were here or not, but they weren't far off.
They
were
had
the
a couple
next stop
people.
From here, if not. And it usually was like two or three guys working in a little room on the side of the fish plant, and they usually employed a blonde girl, tall blonde girl, because they seemed to like the blondes. So anyway, this egg market was lucrative enough that it attracted some illegal egg buyers as well. And there was a stretch of years, kind of in the mid-80s, where this was a big underground trade in certain parts of the interior. Some pilot would come fly in and get these eggs. Then the troopers put it to a stop. The fishermen brought suit against the department saying that this, since they're catching these fish for dogs, they ought to be able to sell the eggs if they wanted to. What was the harm in it? Fish and Game's point of view was that it was going to create a big take of chum salmon beyond the number that people needed for their dogs. So that didn't last for very long, but that was a good source of money while it lasted. Once it was stopped, that was kind of the end of it. It didn't go much further. And that, by the end of the 80s, that was kind of mostly all had come and gone. That would be, I would sort of regard that as a little blip in the...
We sold fish and eggs maybe like a little later than that, because I was with you when we did that.
Yeah,
that
legally.
Legally.
Right.
It was like 95 or 96. I think the last, 96 maybe the last time we sold
right.
eggs.
Well,
something like that.
The other thing that happened, the reason that was the last time we did it and we haven't done it since is because the market collapsed. Basically, the several hatcheries came online down in southeast Alaska that had been funded by the state. They came online and chum numbers were returning in absolute droves to these hatcheries. So all of a sudden, they had more eggs that they knew what to do with. And beyond that, they had more fish than they knew what to do with, and it got to be a real sort of a moral issue for ADF&G because those guys were trying to find uses for these carcasses, And what's the irony in that, of course, is that, you know, Alaska has a very rigorous law about wanton waste, which is a great thing. But here, something that Fish and Game had been promoting was producing this immense quantity of wanton waste. So that put them in a sort of a sticky position. From the point, and it also killed the egg market, and people were pretty sore about that in the interior, because in addition to the illegal egg market, there was also a good legal egg market. People would, especially in the Middle River down around Galena and Caltag, you know, they had fish plants down there that processed eggs, and then people had to keep the carcasses and cut them into dog food. So, you know, at least nominally, they weren't being wasted. So.
I heard you use the terms lower, middle, and upper mm-hmm. river.
Yeah.
Roughly where?
Okay, lower river is District 1, 2, and 3, and that's about as far as Russian Mission. The middle river is from, the way we regard it, is from Russian Mission on through Grayling, Caltag, New Lotto, Koyukuk, Galena, and Ruby. And then District 5, which starts at Tanana,
or just below,
or a little below, goes up as far as Yukon Flats. That's a very active fishing district, District 5, and is considered the upper river. But everything basically from Tanana to the border is kind of considered the upper river in this context. So anyway, people in the interior were pretty sore that this nice market they had disappeared, basically as a result of the fishermen, and the way we perceived it, the fishermen down in Southeast had the ear of AD, F, and G, and the ear of the legislators, who were right handy, so they got this nice fishery and made some pretty good money off it for a while. And it was kind of an interesting situation, too, because the permit value went up at that point.
When
the eggs were going up, the permit value down in Southeast, you know, before that had been sort of a putt-putt fishery. Nobody had been making a lot of money at it, but it got valuable for a while on account of that. So then we got into the early 90s. I think it was around 94 or so, and for some inexplicable reason, chum salmon began declining, and
the runs,
not the size, but the runs, and it was a pretty serious business, and it was also a first for us. They actually shut down the subsistence fishery for a period of a week or two, or three, and during some of those years. And again, I don't remember the specific history of it, but that was a huge deal here. There was protests and, civil disobedience fisheries, and Tananoc Chiefs Conference, which is the regional provider of social services for the interior Athabascan villages, got involved in a big way. And then, of course, the next question was why was it happening, and that was really the mystery, because according to the forecasts, we should have been going into some really good years.
There had been a lot the parent year. There had been a lot of chums there was a big run the parent year, so a lot of eggs would have been laid. They would have gone back to the ocean, and they were assuming that a lot of fish would come back, but they didn't.
3 years. What, three for three, chums, three years?
Three or four, yeah. 3 years. 3 and 4 years, I think.
Okay.
The big ones. Or four.
But there wasn't.
They were just not showing up.
And the thought at the time, I mean, this is an interesting phenomenon, too, because it's a lot, like a lot of things, in times of shortage, the political unrest really begins to soar. And it's that way with the fish, too. So We thought at the time that it was the false pass interception, because these chums, you know, they've done some studies and they sort of know how these guys are coming in. And at the very end of the Alaska Peninsula, just as it's about to turn into the Aleutian Islands, there's a fishery that intercepts the fish that are bound for Bristol Bay. It's a narrow passage, a narrow strait called False Pass. And at one time, they had, I believe, the highest permit value in the state. In other words, you could buy a chance to fish at False Pass for something, if I'm not mistaken, like $230,000 somewhere in there. So these guys were making money hand over fist. They were mostly fishers from Seattle, Bellingham, places like that, and coming into rake up. And what they were trying to intercept for the most part was red salmon going into Bristol Bay, which of course is on the other side of False Pass, you know, from the North Pacific. But apparently they were getting a pretty good bycatch of chums. So
that were bound for the Yukon.
That were bound for, among other places, the Yukon River. But they'd done enough genetic sampling to find out that a lot of them were Yukon-bound fish. So that was thought to be one cause, and We put in a lot of work going to fisheries meetings to try to lobby for a cap on these guys, on these Cape fishermen. Now, two things, a little bit of a diversion here that I think, but are kind of to the point, is like salmon fishermen talk about being Cape fishermen. And this happens both in an island situation like Kodiak, and it does happen on the Yukon as well. The guys who are first in line tend to get the cream of the crop. And although it might be a little harder work in the case of off Kodiak, because you have to have a bigger boat and you have to fish off these capes, which are rough, but they get the first shot at the returning red salmon. And so they get some really good fish and often make a lot of money. The lower Yukon River in our situation is the Cape fishermen, with the caveat that there are actually a lot of fish getting caught further offshore. And maybe if you could remind me about that here in a little bit, I could enlarge upon that. But there does seem to be something about Cape fishermen, and this situation with False Pass was a good example. There's a sense of entitlement. You naturally kind of, as a Cape fisherman, began to think that yours is the highest and best use of the fishermen, of the fish, I mean. And strange as it sounds, I really think that this is something that is a human nature thing, because I feel it myself. I watched this peculiar thing that down at the lower river, they catch the best fish, they catch the most of them. And granted, there's a lot of fishermen and they are very economically dependent on it, but boy, you cut them, any talk of cutting them down and they just squawk, and they just think that any other use of the fish upstream is, in essence, illegitimate. I feel like the interior fishermen are more sort of exposed to the effects of the fish having been taken, and so maybe are a little bit more aware of the fact that these fish are going to the spawning grounds, and what will there be enough or will there not. We take less fish than them, but we at Rapids maybe think that we're sort of entitled to them as well, just because they're good fish and because we can get them. Then, you know, we talk to these guys who are up in Canada. Their so-called Indian food fishery, those guys are lucky if they can catch 5 salmon during the course of the season. They think they're blessed if they can catch 5 salmon. They're the guys who basically own the spawning grounds, and in some ways I see them as sort of occupying the highest moral ground. So it's like this continuum of the lower down the river you are, the less sort of
the sort of lower moral plane or whatever, and the more fish you take. So anyway, these false pass guys, they're cutting a fat hog in the ass. They've got these hugely lucrative fisheries, and they're cutting off our fish. So anyway, the Yukon River kind of banded together for that.
The whole river.
The whole river did. And this whole thing, too, is since salmon are a migratory species, they come through, and this is very much a sort of a, like that Mideast proverb, me and my cousin against the world, me and my brother against my cousin. You know, I mean, these alliances shift, they're sort of temporary. Today, you're working together to, you know, lobby against these guys. Tomorrow, maybe you're lobbying against the people who were your allies before. And the venue in which this all takes place is the Board of Fish meeting. You know, periodically, since I've been fishing, we've had to trot down there to testify before the board to head off some threat or other that is coming to our district. For example, during this time of shortage with the chum salmon, there was the lower river put in proposals to curtail the number of dogs that you could feed fish to. We, of course, were up in arms about that, and so we went down to the fish board meeting to fight that off. It turned out to be a moot point anyway, because the chum shortage ended, and we had a year, I think 2 or 3 years ago, where they had 1 million of them come back, just scads of them. So apparently whatever happened fixed itself, because although the interception at you know, through false pass was kind of curtailed, it didn't seem to necessarily have that much of an effect. The numbers of fish being taken in the river seem to have been declining, but just slowly. And then, you know, for salmon in general, and I think it's more a problem with kings than with chums, there's a big bycatch that's being taken by the pollock fishermen offshore. Pollock are what you eat when you go buy Mrs. What's-His-Name's fish sticks.
Or McDonald's.
Huge market.
This is like the corn of the ocean, and they fish the living hell out of them. So far they seem to be sustaining themselves, but I'm kind of waiting personally for the pollock decline. It seems inevitable considering what they're taking. But this is factory trawling. And they are allowed a certain bycatch of king salmon, which they're not allowed to keep. They have National Marine Fisheries observers that are billeted on these trawlers, and they're supposed to, you know, kind of keep an eye on things that they're being put back. Not
not
kept. In other words, dumped. They're dead when they come in the trawl.
They're dumping them. They're not allowed to make money off them, so they dump them.
Yeah.
Okay, now, I heard that, but I've also heard that they now process the fish and turn the money over to maybe coastal native
fish. Oh.
Oh, okay. Well, that would...
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, now that makes sense. I know there's... I'm not the guy to ask about this, too, but there's something about... I think that Stevens or Young or somebody got going, which is like a co-management thing for coastal fisheries. And I think really the idea of it was, though, although none of the pollock fishermen are based, you know, on the lower Yukon River or any ports anywhere nearby there, you know, one of the main reasons is it's a flat, miserable coast with very little shelter. And so they're all... In terms of shipping and location, they're all based in Dutch Harbor. That's kind of the place they are. But with this happening offshore from them, you know, it might be 100 miles or so, but it's still kind of in their neighborhood. It was a bone to throw to these people.
Which people?
The people in the lower Yukon. see, let them in on a little of this bounty. And I think they, I'm guessing they probably lobbied for it to get it. I don't know how that worked, but they get a cut of all this.
The Lower Yukon.
They get a cut of the pollock fishermen's profits, and I don't know how that works, but I know they've got an arrangement that way. I can't remember what it's called, but.
Can you think of any logic why it wouldn't go to Upper Yukon River fishermen?
Because it's supposed to be coastal.
Fish
and we're not on the coast; river. We're way up in the interior. Yeah, it.
Yeah, another thing that rankles.
Well, the other thing too is that the people on the lower river.
They're already getting the best fish, the most fish.
Yes.
And you guys are getting cut back as they come up the river. And the bycatch favors them, not you?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, they are, the bycatch is to their detriment, but they get a return out of it. They get money.
The bycatch is to our detriment as well.
That's
yeah.
What I'm getting at.
No, and we get no benefit.
We get no benefit.
We get no benefit.
Right.
Right.
Incredible.
Yeah, well, see, it's all about lobbying power, too.
They have a lot more people
at these fishery meetings that we trot out to, you know, on a regular basis. We have to go down, you know, to go lobby the Board of Fish to stop whatever thing there is. I mean, really, we feel like we're fighting this sort of holding action against people who would just as soon see this fishery disappear and stop.
It's this area.
Yeah, it's not the best use of the fish, according to them. Even though it's been going on forever, so you know, whenever we have something like this where we go to these fishery meetings, Board of Fish or whatever, we're like 4, 5, 6, 7 ragtag people: one from Eagle, 2 from Tanana, 1 from Fort Yukon, 1 from Fairbanks, maybe 1 from Nenana or something like that. Real spread out. We're not really in communication with each other much. The Lower Yukon guys, they have a caucus table there. They have a computer set up. They have a hired gun, a guy who used to be a manager with ADF&G, who's now working for them as a consultant. They're organized. They're on it.
They pay their way up, give them a place to stay. I mean, their local...
Right.
They're local, you know.
Yeah, the fishermen, and they seem to be.
I mean, they're whatever it is, their equivalent of TCC, you know, down there.
AVCP
pays their way up. You know, they're very organized. They're, you know, and they all stand up and they all say the same thing, and they get listened to.
How many people do they account for down there?
Oh well, at a typical fish board meeting, there could be 20, 30,
40
of them. And these guys, and they all speak the party line, and they are able to trot out as much testimony as they need. They can always get some nice elder to stand up and say that he depends on these fish. So.
I gotta switch this over.